during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. Now here's your host, Ward Morrow.
Today we'll be joined by AFGE 14th District National Vice President Dwight Bowman, political commentator Armstrong Williams, and labor author Gary Chasen. Welcome back to Inside Government, MVP Bowman.
Well, thank you for having me again. It is a pleasure.
And this is an exciting time here in Washington, D.C. AFGE's thrown its support behind Vincent Gray for the D.C. mayoral race. Tell us how the campaign's going.
The campaign is going terrific. I have never been so enthusiastic about a campaign as I am about this one. We are heavily involved, and we are doing, my folks are just doing a tremendous job. The enthusiasm is high, our folks are looking good, and our candidate is up by at least 8 points right now and just doing a tremendous job.
And, you know, this is a fascinating time to be in Washington, D.C. I mean, we're here in the nation's capital. It's the political center of the United States, and everybody in town pretty much is connected to government or politics, seemingly in one fashion or another. And right here in the middle of all this, we have this big race for mayor. What are you hearing from the actual residents of D.C.?
The residents are giving us tremendous feedback. As you know, we have several thousand members who live in the District of Columbia, and even more who work in the District of Columbia. And we have been out on our campaign walks. We have been doing our phone banks. We've been participating. Our members have been participating with the Gray campaign. We have been participating with the AFL-CIO. And all of the feedback that we're getting is very positive. I'll give you an example. In a two-hour period, we contacted, I think it was about 300 individuals. And of that 300, it looks like the statistics were 1 for Leo Alexander, 12 for Mr. Fenty, and Mr. Gray had 33. And, you know, there were a number of people who were not available, but the numbers were just tremendous. If you look at the differences with regard to 33 for Vincent Gray and 12 for, and I'm sorry, this was about a half an hour period, 33 for Vincent Gray, 12 for Mr. Fenty, and 1 for Leo Alexander, that kind of mimics the statistics that we're getting with regard to the straw polls. I think Vincent Gray has won all but one or two of the straw polls that have gone on throughout the city. And he's won by very good margins in every ward that he has won. And the one loss, I think, was just a narrow victory for Mr. Fenty.
And it certainly seems like people in the neighborhoods, and when you hear sort of anecdotal people talking about the last election, maybe they were for Fenty, in this election they definitely are not. Are you hearing that kind of trend over and over? I mean, I've seen it with lawn signs, people saying last time they had one for Fenty, now they're having one for Gray.
Absolutely. We're seeing that not only with our members, but with the people that they touch, such as their mothers, their brothers, and their cousins who are not district residents or members of the union.
What do you think the biggest election issue is for D.C. voters?
Well, it depends on where you are in the spectrum. For us, for our members, it is a jobs issue. It is for some people taxes. It is for some people the schools. Different groups have different interests. You have the tenants associations. You have the realtors, and as you know, the business community has come over to Gray's side. So everybody has their own issue, and what we're seeing across the board is that folks are looking to Gray to bring leadership and continuity to the city, to see all factions of the city working together.
And as you mentioned, the different factions, I mean, we've highlighted this in the past on the show, but I think it's important that over a number of years now, there's been a pattern here where labor has kind of reached out to Mayor Fenty, including even our show, saying, you know, please come on our show, we'd be glad to have you. And simply kind of getting a stone wall. I mean, they're not interested in engaging with labor, not interested in engaging with the employees who do the job here in Washington. Are you finding that employees are reacting to that now?
Extremely. We had an appreciation party for our members last Saturday evening at the Zanzibar. We had probably maybe 1,500 people who came through that night, and they were overwhelmingly supportive of Mr. Gray and his campaign. It's very clear that his message is resonating throughout the city, and I think every faction recognizes that Mr. Fenty has not been responding to them, has not been giving them an opportunity to be a part, a party to where the city is going.
And how would this sort of anti-worker sentiment change if Gray were elected mayor, in your opinion?
Well, as I said before, Mr. Gray, we do not expect him to agree with us on every point. But one thing that he has done throughout his career, and one thing that we expect to continue, is his having an open door policy to us, and at listening to us, and at least giving us an entree, giving us an opportunity to have our voices heard. And that's one of the most important things that any leader or any politician can do.
And, you know, the federal employees have certainly seen when the Obama administration came in, the sort of going back to the partnerships the Clinton administration had, where labor and management would sit down together, and it wasn't necessarily doing something in particular for the union, but simply dialoguing, having a chance to talk back and forth, see what some of the issues are, see if there's some way to come to some common ground. Do you think that maybe we would come back to something like that?
Absolutely. One of the things that Chairman Gray has talked about is the relationship that the unions had with the administrations in the past. Our ability to sit down and talk things over to figure out what would be best for the city. It's certainly going to be the mayor's final decision as to what actions are taken in any given situation, but the idea of having all of the vested interests having a say and contributing to the outcome is extremely important. You know, our what we say around here is Mr. Fenty campaigned like Obama, but govern like Mr. Bush. And noting how he has turned to outsiders to come in and support him is indicative of what we do not like in this city. We like to see our people, our mayors, our administrators respond to the residents and the vested interest in the city, not to outsiders.
And as you kind of look at how the campaign is coming together, how are the various interest groups kind of breaking down in terms of who they're supporting? The realtors, the cab drivers, various business interests, firefighters, police, that sort of thing.
Well, to tell the truth, everyone, even if they're not saying it out loud and openly, is moving towards Gray. If they're not already in his camp, there are those who are supposed to be supporting Mr. Fenty who are giving clear indication that they're not satisfied with the way that the city is going. And as individuals, even though they may belong to a group, they're leaning towards Gray. That is something which is warming to my heart.
And as you look forward to see Chairman Gray move into being mayor, what do you think would be a good sort of first order of business for him? What would be a good first step?
Well, certainly the best thing that he can do is to sit down with us and ask us to join him in providing service to the residents of the District of Columbia, to assist him with that.
And let's talk about some of the events you've got coming up in the coming weeks to prepare for the election. What kinds of things? You mentioned some, but what kinds of things are people getting involved in?
Well, we are working with what is called the Independent Campaign, which is being sponsored by the Central Labor Council. We're also working with the Central Labor Council on labor-to-labor. We're doing our own labor-to-labor, meaning that we're talking to our own members about what is going on in the city, about their future as public employees. We're doing phone banks. Some of our members are independently setting up fundraisers. We're having breakfasts, parties, all kinds of things that involve the membership to let them know what is happening in the city and what we're doing to help. We have labor, we have media committees, and all kinds of events that we're going to be having between now and the 14th of September.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members, government and military employees. Looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required, no credit checks, and AFGE members get a 6% discount. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com. Have you been to AFGE's new online store? Members and activists can now purchase AFGE items online using a credit card and have them conveniently shipped right to your door. Visit the store at www.afgestore.org. You'll be able to buy all the hottest AFGE products, from hats and watches to coffee mugs and pens, plus the famous Inside Government t-shirts. That's more than 70 items to choose from. Start shopping today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Armstrong Williams, political commentator and host of The Right Side TV Show. Welcome to Inside Government.
Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you for having me.
So we're headed into the contentious midterm elections this November. What are your thoughts on the election?
Well, you know, obviously, the American people have been in a fiery mood since the since 2000 and the year President Obama was elected. And obviously, if you look at from Virginia to New Jersey to Massachusetts, Arlington, Pennsylvania, a lot of people have just been fired along the way. And Republicans have not been spared part of this firing by the American people. But it does seem that President Barack Obama, someone that I did vote for, by the way, and had great promise for, it does seem that he does not have much left in his arsenal that can turn the economy around, that can create jobs. And with Obamacare about to take place, and if you look at the numbers of what people assume is going to happen to the economy after Obamacare really takes shape in terms of payroll taxes, in terms of whether employers are going to have to lay off additional employees to meet the demands of what is being asked of them, it remains to be seen. And obviously, there's a reason why the president numbers are in the toilet, that yes, he definitely inherited a mess from past presidents, but obviously, you know, Vice President Biden declared 18 months ago, that 18 months later, that the stimulus package would turn this economy around and everyone would witness it, and we have not come close to that declaration that he made. And so unless this president, unless something miraculous happens and this economy, especially unemployment situation, turns around very quickly, I think it's unavoidable, Ward, in November, what the outcome is going to be. I guess the real issue is just how devastating will it be? Can the Republicans, because they really don't have a message, and there's not really anything that they've done of substance. They don't really have a candidate, a faceplate, to really challenge what the president is doing. What they basically do is criticize. I mean, you can criticize him on immigration because he hasn't really done anything to do to change and to revamp illegal immigration in this country as he promised. I don't think deep down, if the Republicans were in the office, that the economy would be any greater. I just don't think that they would have initiated some of the policies that the president did that is further devastating the economy. And so the sad news is that they don't have to do anything. They're the beneficiaries of a lot of failed policies that have just not worked. There's no question. The question remains as to whether or not they can regain the House and the Senate again. I think there's a strong possibility for the House unless Patty Murray loses in Washington State. That's why the president is there. I think that's the best chance for them regaining the Senate. But it could also become their Achilles heel because it will remind you of what happened when President Clinton was able to dump the Senate leadership and the House leadership and able to find his own voice. So even if the president loses the House and the Senate, it may be a blessing in disguise. It could assure him for re-election in 2000 and in his next presidential election cycle.
Well, and as the parties are sort of framing these issues in debate, as you mentioned, the Republicans don't seem to have much of a message, or maybe the message is, you know, cut taxes for the extreme wealthy. That seems to be their message. Well, the Democrats are maybe a little more muted.
I don't think that's a fair statement. Cut taxes for the extreme wealthy. The extreme wealthy have always had their taxes cut. I think that's a shout. I think it's much more deeper than that. I think if you look at it on a deeper level, I think that everybody should have skin in the game when it comes to the tax system. I think the problem now is why people don't feel they're affected by whatever happened with the taxes, because so many people in this country don't pay taxes. I think there's a strong advocacy for a flat tax where everybody pays the same rate no matter what their wealth category is. So when these administrations, when they come and go and they try to revamp these tax policies and they put these policies in place, everybody would have something at stake because everybody has skin in the game. So I don't think it's about the – I don't think the Republicans and Democrats on a certain level are any different. I think they all protect special interest groups. I don't think they all protect the wealthy because that's where the bulk of their money comes from to run their campaigns.
Well, and as you mentioned in a recent column, you talked about the nastiness in Washington, and it's hurting our ability to move forward as a nation. I mean, even when you think of an issue like Social Security, you mentioned a flat tax. If we took the cap off and we taxed all the extreme wealthy people at the same rate as working people, you know, that would probably save Social Security through the next century. But nobody's really talking about those things. Do you think it's possible to get past partisanship and do what's necessary for the good of the people?
Well, that's a very good point. I think it's a salient point, but I don't think our government, unlike if you look at places like the United Kingdom, the president, the prime minister there has real power. Here in the United States, it was really set up where the president and our Congress have the true power because you have the three branches of government, the federal, the judiciary, and the legislative. And as much as you like it or not, the bottom line is it's set up where you have members of Congress who seek a re-election every 2 years, the Senate every 6 years, and the president every 4 years. And so in order to stay in power, you have to allow yourself to get in bed with these special interest groups and these lobbyists. And the sad news is that the lobbyists and the special interest groups who are funding these campaigns are writing and rewriting laws, and they're not rewriting and writing these laws for the best interests of everyday Americans. And when you have a system like this that's been in place for so long, it builds up. And this is the kind of country that you have now. You just can't blame the president for the crisis that we're in, not even Bush and Clinton. It's that our laws, even when they suspended the Glass-Steagall, which nobody talks about, investment bankers, investment houses should never have been allowed to become bankers also. There's an inherent conflict of interest. So it's just inherent in the way our government is set up. And you can talk about these politicians putting laws in place and Nancy Pelosi talking about cleaning the swamp and you talking about having these ethical panels. But if you were to look at anybody's background, not just Maxine Waters or Charlie Rangel, if you were to look at any Republican or Democratic legislature on Capitol Hill's background and look at their filings and their finances close enough, you could find something to launch an investigation.
Well, you know, and as we move forward, let's talk about some specific examples that you think both sides could make some concessions to move forward. I mean, I'm thinking in this era where you've got like the Tea Party moving the conservatives in the Republican Party even further to the right. How do you get people towards the center or get to a position where maybe they make deals in the interest of moving the American government forward?
Listen, everything boils down to, it's just that you don't have people like George Washington and those anymore who only wanted to serve for certain terms and did not want to become career politicians. When our founders set this up, they never envisioned career politicians. They envisioned a farmer, maybe a radio broadcaster, maybe a factory worker, maybe a housewife, maybe a CEO would go and serve for 4 or 8 years and then return home. As long as you have career politicians, Ward, nothing's going to ever change. I mean, and so some of the issues that they could probably work together on, something really needs to be done about illegal immigration in this country. Something they could work together on. You mentioned the flat tax. I mean, certainly the rule of law is sort of the pillar of which any society has to function. But you know what? In order to return to these things that we call virtue, it was the family, and it was the focus of the family. It was in the homes. It was in the churches. It's in the school. See, a lot more has to be done than just simplifying laws and looking at politicians. People have to look within themselves and remind themselves of what made America great. If you look at a country that has less laws, it can sort of tell you that it is a thriving country with less problems. There's so many laws that are on the books because it reflects who we are as the people. What Americans have to realize that there's just certain things, while the government may take a role in health care, we have to be honest and tell people that you've got to exercise, that you've got to eat better, you got to enforce these laws against these people who put these toxics in the food and the vegetables and things that we eat. There's so many things that if people were to take a better look at their own health and just a little exercise every day, we would not have many of the health crises that we have in this country today. And so we tend to want to believe that the government is the solution to everything, but a government that is big enough to give you everything is big enough to take it away. We have to turn to read the people. We have to go back to one of the things that I read about when I was in Europe was about how Russia went into the crisis with its wheat. It's not producing its wheat, and now the world is looking to the American farmer. And so wheat prices are soaring in this country. American farmers, wheat farmers are back to work. We need to get back and revitalize farms in this country. I mean, get it where we produce our own. So much of that is discouraged because of the import-export situation that we're in. We need to go back. I mean, even before the Great Depression, Ward, I don't know if you realize this or not, but 78% of the people in this country were entrepreneurs because we were producing for ourselves. We were industrialists. We were manufacturing. So a lot of that has gone away, and now we're in a technological age, and you ask yourself, what are we producing now? And the answer would be not much.
Well, and as we move into a more technological age, education's obviously going to be an important part of that.
Yes.
And I know education has been important to you. Can you talk to us about maybe some of the best ways we can move education forward?
Well obviously, education is an issue where you have to understand when you talk about education, you cannot neglect to understand the breakdown of a two-parent household and the impact that it has on a child's education. You know, it's an interesting thing if you think about education. More people were illiterate before 1960 than they are today. Isn't that a frightening statistic? When you consider where this country was, I mean, obviously, kids must return to a healthy respect of learning. The intellectual gap in education starts before the child ever in a kindergarten. Parents must understand they've got to turn off that TV, they've got to have books, they've got to encourage kids to read, encourage kids the importance of learning, and teach kids about discipline. But also, it cannot be about passing some tests. One of the faults of No Child Left Behind, which I shouldn't know much about, is that everything is centered around a test score, so you're just studying for a test. It has to be more than just about a test. It has to be about learning history. We got to encourage people to get back into the math and sciences. I mean, if you look at where America once were, when you think about our leadership in the math and sciences, we're almost near the bottom. You look at the number of scientists and mathematicians that the Chinese and other countries develop. We've got to get back to the engineering, the kinds of things that builds the infrastructure of this country. And so people must understand that it all starts with education, especially in an industrial society. We used to have this thing when we were growing up called vocational schools, and we used to have this thing called homemaking classes where young ladies could learn special skills and guys could go and learn how to weld, learn carpentry. Those things have no longer exist now. We must understand that not everybody's going to be an engineer, not everybody's going to be a doctor, and for those who don't measure up, you at least have to find out what their skills, what their gifts are, and have them go to some kind of vocational class or some kind of vocational school for 2 years so you can hone those skills of the things that they really have expertise in.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Gary Chasen, author of Unions in America. Welcome to Inside Government.
Thank you.
So tell us a little about your book, Unions in America.
Well, I decided to write a book about 3 or 4 years ago in order to discuss what unions in America are and what they do and why they do it. And I was getting a little fed up around that time with everyone talking about unions, but quite often not knowing what unions are and what they do. So I wanted to have an informative book. I just wanted to describe unions, their evolution, their objectives, collective bargaining, organizing, and political action, and talk about what their plans for renewal are, and just see if I can speculate about the unions of the future.
Now, you have a little bit of background in unions, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Let's talk about that.
Okay, well, I've been teaching industrial relations now for probably 30 years, I guess, since 40 years, okay? And I taught for Canada in 10 years, okay? And I come from a family where my father was a labor lawyer in New York City, and I've been involved in a union organizing campaign at a Canadian university, and I've sat on arbitration boards in Canada as well.
And can you talk for just a second about the difference between Canadian labor law and what we do in the United States?
Well, Canadian labor law looks at itself as fairly orderly. Okay? And before strikes can occur, they try to impose conciliation similar to mediation. And they quite often believe in boards. There's a very strong British element there, where they have a board which has a union nominee, a management nominee, and a chair to make arbitration decisions as well as to make decisions about collective bargaining and the right to strike. So Canadian unions also tend to be much more socially oriented and see themselves as not only the voice of working men and women who are union members and work at unionized plants, but in the society in general. And the government, of course, is much more amenable to their suggestions.
And although this could probably easily be a two-semester class, could you give us a brief history of unions?
Okay. That's hard to say, but let's just say that the purpose of a labor union, okay, in the traditional sense in the United States, is to take wages, hours, and the conditions of employment out of competition so that workers as individuals don't compete among each other but have a voice in the workplace through a collective organization, the labor union. And much of American labor history has been history of employer opposition to unions, workers fighting without any legal protections to have a voice in, or some type of a say in what they get paid and how they work, and often the state siding with employers. And more recently, within the last 70 or 80 years, we've had a fairly well-established doctrine that whether or not there'll be unionization at a place of employment will be a decision made by the workers themselves, and that workers should have a say in how their place is run, that collective bargaining is good for the country. If workers choose to go the collective bargaining route as opposed to individual bargaining or unilateral employer action. And so much of the labor history in the United States is unions pushing, employers reacting very strongly quite often, and workers feeling a need to express themselves at the workplace. A variety of organizations and federations can do this with different views about how best to carry this out.
And, you know, a lot of times people that are members of unions, they kind of look at history beginning with the National Labor Relations Act or in the federal sector, you know, with the executive order. But labor unions in the United States have been around for a long time. And let's talk for a minute about, like, the Knights of Labor, these things that existed long before the National Labor Relations Board was set up.
Well, labor unions have been around for a long, long time. And the earliest unions were formed among skilled groups of workers in the 1780s and 90s who not because their working conditions were the worst, but who felt that they could effectively negotiate because they had the ability to strike. They were difficult to replace. And the early labor unions were unions which essentially had to organize without any legal protections at all. The courts and the laws were very much against what they were doing, and employers had easy recourse to the courts to try to prevent organizing from happening. So it wasn't really until the 1930s, the New Deal period, that collective bargaining became a socially and economically acceptable process. And that, and then in the 1960s, and I remember this well, where collective bargaining spread to public employees, and there was a great debate about whether it was appropriate for the public worker and whether there could be real bargaining without the right to strike, and very controversial at that time. So to some degree, the way that we deal with employers through unions now dates to the 1930s, even though there's a prehistory of that, and in the public sector, it dates to the 1960s.
And, you know, as you talk about that, the rise of public sector unionism, and of course the AFG has been a large part of that, has changed the demographics of who's in a union in some ways, and also really the private sector versus the public sector, and that kind of shift, the private sector seeming to be harder to organize almost in some ways. Can you talk a little about that?
Well, the reason is that we have much higher unionization rates in the private sector than in the public sector than in the private sector. In fact, about 37% of all government workers and only 7% of all private sector workers are members of unions. And the reason we have that are, I think, primarily twofold. One is that public employers don't resist unions the way that private employers do. They don't fight unionization because it's politically inappropriate to do so, and that workers are voters and it doesn't look right. Okay, and also they don't have the option of relocating. You just can't take a city government of Boston and move it to Mexico. It just isn't done. Okay, so to some degree, public employers don't have the weapons. And there was for a large period of time a belief that what was appropriate for individual workers were private workers was also appropriate for government workers, and that the rights should be extended to those workers, and that there should be bargaining if they were to have a meaningful voice. The idea of a civil service worker as being a working elite lost a lot of its meaning in the 1940s and 50s, and I think as a result there was a feeling that collective bargaining was not only appropriate but needed for public employees.
Now, I heard at a meeting once a discussion of the Employee Free Choice Act, and obviously the AFL-CIO is looking at that as a way to make it easier to organize in the private sector. Are there some things that they do differently in Canada in terms of that? I mean, I remember hearing that actually it was much, much easier to organize in Canada, even beyond the Employee Free Choice Act. I mean, there were things that were done separately.
I think the ease of organizing in Canada was largely a phenomenon of the 70s and 80s. And for many years in Canada, the individual provinces, and that's what really determines labor law in Canada mostly, the individual provinces could certify a union based on card counts rather than elections. And in fact, I was involved in an organizing campaign at a university in a Canadian province where we proved our majority support by using signed membership cards. But many of those provinces, and might just be all, I'm not really sure, have rescinded those laws and require elections or a mixture of elections and card counts. If the sign-up is not large or is in question, there will be an election. And I think that more workers are unionized in Canada. The overall proportion is in probably about 28 or 30%, as opposed to the United States, where it's about 12%, because Canadian employers do not resist unionization that strongly. And that Canadian workers have more of a belief in collective action as opposed to individual action. They're much more amenable towards union organizing.
And in the United States, are there certain areas of the country, certain states that seem to have a higher union density and certain maybe job classifications versus others?
Well, that's an important factor. In the United States, there's always a state that you can move your plant to. If you're in New Jersey or New York or California where probably a quarter of the workers are unionized, you can always move it to Texas, where about 5% are organized, or South Carolina or North Carolina or states like those, and where there's no tradition of unionization, where there are unions are few and far between. And where it's easy to avoid unionization simply by geography and going into a largely non-union culture and environment. In Canada, there's really not all that much difference between the provinces. Some are more heavily unionized, like Ontario, than others, but even in provinces like Saskatchewan and Alberta, I think large proportions of workers are unionized, so there's no escape for the Canadian employer unless the Canadian employer wants to go overseas.
And to change topics a little bit, in your book you discuss a lot about union democracy.
Yes.
Tell us a little more about union democracy and some of the processes that unions use.
Okay, union democracy is a very difficult issue to define because we're really not sure what democracy is, but I think over the years we've determined what it's not. And my definition of bureaucracy would just be that the membership has significant influence over the leadership of the union. It doesn't mean that the leadership is thrown out in elections or that there's continuous party systems or whatever, but there's influence from the bottom up. Okay? And we expect unions to be democratic because they're membership organizations. We evaluate their performance not only on the basis of whether they do well at the bargaining table, but whether they do well democratically. That is, there's ratification of the agreement, and the agreement is what the members want. We expect them to be democratically run. We don't expect corporations to be democratically run. We expect members to participate in their unions, and we expect the collective agreement and the results of union activity to reflect the wishes of the members, because these are membership organizations. Essentially, democratic organizations function better as if they're membership organizations, or I should say membership organizations function better if they're democratically run. And that's why we emphasize union democracy. We don't emphasize corporate democracy. General Motors can build a new model of a car without consulting all of its employees, but you can't have the approval of a collective agreement in the UAW unless the membership votes on it, nor can you ask them to be mobilized and go out on strike unless they approve of that.
Now, of course, what a lot of people don't understand about unions is that the Department of Labor has a lot of things that they do in terms of oversight of unions, a lot of things that are required to be published in union newsletters, that sort of thing, timelines, none of which apply to businesses.
That's right. The U.S. Department of Labor enforces the Landrum-Griffin Act, the Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act, which tells when elections will occur and gives workers a right to participate in the elections within the union and political activities in general within the union. In other words, the government says that the democratic operations is good for labor unions and should be promoted and protected. And they do this by also collecting financial reports, the belief that if the union's officers can be responsible for the financial operations within the union, and if there's transparency in union financial operations, they'll be more democratic as well.
And how do union members judge and appraise their leaders? You've done some research into this.
Union leaders are judged on whether or not they can deliver, okay, and whether or not they can deliver at the bargaining table, whether or not they appear to be in tune with what the membership wants. It's not whether or not we think, or the general public thinks they're doing well. It's what the membership wants. And the union members will at times put up with some corrupt leaders or far-left leaders, but they'll do so if they feel that they can deliver at the bargaining table, if they're effective, if they can get what the membership wants, and if they know what's going on. The head of the leadership of the United Automobile Workers, for instance, has been very astute in how the industry is run. Okay? And the leaders of most labor unions who rose through the ranks understand how the jobs are conducted, how the companies do or employers do, and they can deliver at the bargaining table. They understand what's going on. They can't be fooled into something that's not appropriate.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Are you an AFGE member who loves the great outdoors? Then the AFGE Union Sportsmen's Alliance benefit is perfect for you. Whether it's fins, furs, or feathers that calls you, the Union Sportsmen's Alliance has you covered. This unique benefit is a community of hunters and fishermen who share the Union Brotherhood. That's right, an exclusive hunting and fishing club by and for Union members, retirees, and their families. Your $25 membership gets you money-saving discounts on great outdoor gear and services, a free MyTopo.com online mapping subscription, a one-year subscription to a top outdoor magazine, and a $25 gift certificate for Beretta Field Gear. You'll also receive a subscription to the Union Sportsman's Journal. To learn more about this exciting benefit, please visit the member benefits page at afge.org or call us at 877-872-2211. That's 877-872-2211. Join today.
Have you been to AFGE's new online store? Members and activists can now purchase AFGE items online using a credit card and have them conveniently shipped right to your door. Visit the store at www.afgestore.org. You'll be able to buy all the hottest AFGE products, from hats and watches to coffee mugs and pens, plus the famous Inside Government t-shirts. That's more than 70 items to choose from. Start shopping today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're continuing with Gary Chasen, author of Unions in America. We're talking about union democracy. What are some of the key factors that you believe union officers or rank-and-file folks might need to get elected or re-elected in a union?
Well, I think one of the things they need is they need notoriety. They have to be known, okay, within the union. And this can create some problems for people who work for a while and then drop out of the labor force and then come back. This is one of the reasons why so few women are union officers, because they tend to have difficulty going to meetings quite often, which are held in the evening, and they often leave their work and then come back to their work. They need notoriety. They need to be known within the union, and they need to rise within the ranks of the union. It takes a lot of patience to do this and a lot of skill. But to move from being unpaid to paid, from a committee position to a local leadership position to a regional leadership position to a national leadership position, it's a slow route, okay? But it's one which can lead to a great deal of satisfaction for officers of unions.
Now let's switch gears a little bit and talk again about organizing. How do unions go about organizing and recruiting new members?
It's a difficult question. This is one that's been asked for a long, long time, and I think there are some common rules here. What the unions will try to do is work within the law, and which requires that they prove their majority support. And this is quite often done through certification elections, which are conducted by the National Labor Relations Board, a government agency that is for private sector unions. Public sector unions usually have their own boards, National Mediation Board, for instance, for the railroads and the airlines and so on. But it's a process of persuading workers, essentially the psychological process of persuading workers that they should take a risk, that there is more to be gained through collective action than they can through individual action, and that they should take a risk by having an outside organization deal with their employer in their behalf. I think in most organizing campaigns, there'll be one-third of the workers will be immediately for that. One-third of the workers will be against it under all circumstances, and one-third will be wavering. And I think organizers really look at the middle third and try to convince those workers who say, I like the idea, but I'm not sure, to say, I'm willing to go for it, I'm willing to try it. That's what organizing is about. It's getting individual workers, usually by one-on-one contacts between organizers, to say, I think things can be done differently, and I'm willing to put aside my individual desires to fulfill the collective good at the workplace and have a voice at the workplace.
And, you know, there seem to be some changes in how this kind of recruitment takes place. I mean, you mentioned, like, in Canada, there's maybe more of a social aspect almost to unions. And in today's modern workforce in the United States, I mean, some organizing seems to take place over Facebook, the Internet, websites. You can join unions through that now. Do you think that's changing the role of organizing, or do you think the face-to-face at the work site, in the parking lots, the home visits, do you think that's still important too?
Well, I worry that unions will try to take the cheap way out, okay, and to use Facebook or Twitter or their own websites to organize workers and to try to do the whole process electronically. Essentially, the individual worker is being asked to make a deep personal decision about their employment and about how they're going to deal with their employer at the workplace. And this is something that can only be done, I think, through personal contact. It involves risks. It involves benefits. Workers have to weigh these. And I don't think it's necessarily something for the middle group of workers who are not quite sure. I don't think it's something that you can deal with them on a website or impersonally through some kind of a brochure that's given to them or a leaflet in the parking lot of the place. It really requires that there be individual contact. Because the workers are not only evaluating the process of organizing and of being represented in collective bargaining, they're evaluating the union that is there to organize them, and they're evaluating the individual who's organizing the workplace, as well as the other workers who are involved in that process. So it's a multi-layered and very complex decisional process.
And one of the things that maybe isn't transparent about unions, particularly people that are not a member, is the power of collective bargaining and how that fits into the union strategy. Talk to us a little bit about what some of the strategies unions have when they try to use collective bargaining in dealing with management.
Okay, well, collective bargaining is a very mysterious process, and I've been teaching a collective bargaining course for a number of years. But it's a negotiation process, okay, in which the parties begin very far apart and somehow converge because it's going to cost them more to disagree than to agree. They'd rather reach a settlement than not reach a settlement, even though no one's happy in bargaining. No one ends up being happy in bargaining, but they're happy relative to what the alternative would have been. That you can't always get what you want in collective bargaining, but you can get something that's okay. And that's what bargaining is about. It's essentially asking for what you don't expect to get in order to get what you do expect to get. It's a large element of theater. It's a large element of give and take in bargaining and intimidation. It's a process in which individual workers can achieve more, I think it's been shown, by negotiating through a union as a collective organization than they could individually. We have instances in which professional athletes, for instance, would negotiate through an agent as an individual and then add to that through their collective bargaining agreement. And that's where the two processes are compatible. But for the average worker, you don't do that well negotiating as an individual when there are a lot of other workers out there and the employer has control over the job. You do much better as a collective where it's all or nothing.
Well, you know, a lot of employees will say, well, I would have gotten those things anyway, or particularly you find some employees who say, well, I'm a good employee. I don't need this. I don't need a union. I'm well-liked. I do my job. Talk us through a little more of the negotiation process. How do we get those kind of things that you wouldn't get anyway?
Well, what happens in the negotiation process is that the union comes in asking for something, which it doesn't expect to get, its demands, and the employer responds with what it's willing to give more than its counteroffer. And the part, as they talk about it, they in order to justify their demands, they go up, they converge, they reach a middle ground. I don't know if you can accept either party's belief that without the bargaining process, they would have reached that point anyway. There's a mystery to bargaining, and that is, in order to avoid a disagreement, you're willing to give in a little. There's a convergence, there's a moving together of demands and offers that you find in bargaining that you wouldn't necessarily find as an individual.
Do you find any trends in bargaining? I mean, traditionally, as we mentioned, it's things like pay and benefits, working conditions, days and hours of work, pension plans. Is it still that, or are there new things on the table?
Well, bargaining has changed in the last 10 years. And I think in many instances, particularly in the private sector, we've gone back to the process, and increasingly in the public sector, we've gone back to a process that was in vogue in the early 1980s, that is concession bargaining. And this is almost a bargaining in reverse, where management acts and the union reacts, where management asks for wage cuts or wage freezes, where defined benefit pension plans are turned into defined contribution pension plans, where the employer uses bargaining to reduce labor costs, and where the union negotiates backwards. It gives up things that it's given in the past. And usually it's gotten in the past. And usually the reason for this is that the employer has a threat, and there's some credibility to that threat. That is, unless labor costs are cut, unless wages are cut or frozen, there will be mass layoffs, plant closings, or whatever. Okay. So it's almost a bargaining in the past, bargaining in reverse, where unions are trying to protect their past gains, and employers are trying to be on the offensive, control the bargaining agenda, and get what was get back what was given in the past.
And let's do, as the academics like to say, a paradigm shift. What can we do to change that? I mean, I think you're correct. There does seem to be this race to the bottom that if the unions, and I saw this with the auto workers, you know, if the unions don't pay, you know, the bare minimum wage or something for building an auto, they'll just go overseas. Or obviously in the public sector, when unions get very involved in politics and maybe elect people they think are their friends, the first thing their friends want to do is say to the unions, how can we save money? What can we cut? How do we shift this so that workers actually start making gains?
Okay, I think one of the things that has to be done here is to make this only a temporary process when it does occur, and that to say we are willing in the short term to make concessions, but we expect to get them back. This is a one-time only deal. We will help the company to save jobs, but we don't want to become a junior partner in success and a senior partner in failure. We don't want the recovery of the company to be done on our back. And we expect to regain what we've given. We're going to be flexible in bargaining and realistic in bargaining, but we're not going to give up everything we've gotten in the past. We want a voice in the process, and we want something in return for this. We want to be on the board of directors of the company, or we want to have a say over plant relocation decisions, or we want to have a clause in a collective agreement saying jobs will not be cut if we reduce our wages or benefits. And that in the future, we reserve the right to negotiate forward on these things, not just backwards, as we have in the past. So I think that concession bargaining, if it's looked at as a temporary reaction, unions can deal with. But if it's looked at as a new way of dealing, a new pattern, unions should be very hesitant to get involved with it.
Do you think that's going to mean, you know, if you're down to 7% in the private sector? Are we going to have to be organizing in new or different industries, or do you think maybe the political activity needs to be emphasized, get the Employee Free Choice Act, something along those lines?
Well, I think for one thing that the political activity has to be linked with union organizing. Okay? I don't think union organizing doesn't occur in the vacuum. It occurs according to certain rules, and that my personal belief is there has to be greater funding for the National Labor Relations Board and a stiffening of penalties for employers who violate the Act. I personally am not a proponent of the Employee Free Choice Act because I feel it tries to do too much, and as a way it's just asking to be defeated. And I think that political action has to be a part of the union repertoire. You cannot bargain, you cannot organize, and not do politics. Politics is vitally important, but you have to not be taken advantage of. You have to really get rewards from your friends if you are to count them as your friends in politics.
And as we come down to our last minute, predictions for the future. What does the future hold for unions?
Well, it's difficult to say. I think that it's going to be very difficult to restart organizing, and most unions will become smaller because organizing is a very expensive and time-consuming process. And a lot of unions don't want to do that dirty work of gaining a few members here and a few members there. I think that unions are going to have to find a way to deal with globalization, okay? And more than just say, don't do it. Okay? They have to find a way to be able to produce greater, okay, so that the labor costs are not so much greater than the labor costs elsewhere. And they have to deal with the issue of globalization. And this requires that they take concrete steps and pilot programs, but do more than just have a lot of conferences and try to prohibit globalization. And I think one of the problems is the labor movement is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and people, if it does so, people will not look at it as a legitimate voice of working men and women and their families. Okay? You can't represent 12% of American workers and claim to be their voice at the same time. And so I think that the key thing has to be revival, and revival means through growth. Every time you negotiate backwards or you do a poor deal or you get engaged in a strike that's crippling to a company, it hurts you in organizing. Every time that you do something politically that's unpopular, it hurts you in organizing. And essentially, organizing is where the power to bargain and the power to deal politically all comes from.
say thank you to our guests this week, AFGE 14th District National Vice President Dwight Bowman, political commentator Armstrong Williams, and labor author Gary Chasen. And that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power.